My name is Hugo, and I'm an alcoholic. Well, I guess that's a good starting point. I have no idea what I was going to say, but like that's the starting point. I think it is really remarkable for me to be here. I was just talking to Lance right now about how, I guess, in a way, how much I've changed since I've been here. There were times at the beginning of the program where, I guess, not having any moments where I thought there was absolutely no hope about anything that I could do. Okay. And the things that have changed, and I think the main thing that has changed for me is that as time has gone by, I've acquired certain tools, and those tools are the 12 steps. And that's even reluctantly, because even I think despite myself, because I've done a lot of things to sabotage my sobriety, different types of, depending on whatever it was that I was involved at the time, I've just tried in different ways. Get away from the program, do this, do that. But despite everything, life has gotten a hell of a lot better. I've shared it on several occasions about the fact that there were 3 weeks during last month which were really kind of tough. But despite the fact that they were tough, the big difference was that because there's a solution and because I've become aware of one thing, is that things change throughout time. I mean, I can be happy today, but tomorrow maybe I'll be a little bit worse off, or being worse off, things will get better the next day. And one thing that remains constant, even in change, is the fact that change will happen. And that's kind of sometimes the only thing that I can hope for, depending on, you know, how bad I'm feeling at the time. But, I grew up in Central America, in Guatemala. A lot of you know that. And during the time that I was growing up, Some of the things that I never knew about was about alcoholism. I remember now having gone into an AA meeting in Guatemala, not knowing that it was an AA meeting. Actually, I think it was a conference, but, you know, the conference was about as big as this. You know, it was just not very big. And I asked a friend of mine what was going on, and he said, "These people are talking about not drinking." And I said, "Oh, yeah." So I just left, you know, because the way that I was taught was that you drank because that was the normal thing to do. You drank to be a man, you drank to be accepted, you drank to belong to all the different things. And every time that I would do something, I did it behind drugs or alcohol. When it was to get a woman to go to bed with me, I would always entice them or thought I could trick them in one way or another, either through alcohol or drugs. Or I conned myself into believing that I was braver or much more valuable than actually I thought I really was. And of course, these patterns that I adopted, not based on reality at all, I kept them on through all my life. I made choices in regards to what I thought I was and the way that I should behave that was not based on any reality whatsoever. And of course, they affected me in everything that I did, whether it was because I wanted to look for a job. I never could accept the possibility that maybe I was worth anything to begin with, because always the truth was never enough. And what I ended up doing was I always had to elaborate everything. And as time went by, of course, you know, I started realizing things were not necessarily working, and I did this gigantic geographic, you know. I moved from Guatemala to the United States again, and, you know, I just thought I needed to change. I'd always liked the United States a lot, and I remember a lot of stuff when I was here, and because I spent some of the time here in the United States since I was up until I was the age of 12. And I missed some of that freedom. We started getting some of the hippies over there, you know. And I thought that was pretty neat, because I never tried pot before, and when I started, oh, man, it was just way down my alley. And one of my cousins started immediately introducing me to what was mushrooms. And then we started trying, we got into acid, we got into coke, we tried everything. We'd go on weekends to the countryside and cut mushrooms. And his way to mellow the mushrooms out was to, you know, just smoke about as much as we could. And this sort of gave it a nice combination. Then we'd go to this place, and we'd play dominoes with a few more drinks. And I never thought about anything exceptional out of that. But by the time I made that geographic, everything was going on wrong. I had been avoiding job after job, changing always just in the nick of time before they discovered that maybe there was something wrong, that I wasn't doing what I was supposed to be doing. And I kept on moving from job to job. As time passed by, and I considered that maybe it was a possibility that something my personality needed to change, so I grew a beard. And that was another way for me to do a geographic, I guess. And when a beard didn't work, I'd let my mustache grow. And when my mustache didn't grow, I'd shave it all off again. Or I tried changing clothes. Or I tried changing girlfriends. Or I knew something was wrong, but I couldn't quite put my finger on it. I never, not even in the most wildest dream, imagined that maybe drugs and alcohol had anything to do with it at all. So one day, I took a very safety type of approach as far as my next job, and I went into the Air Force. Because I thought, well, you know, I need some time to think things over. And in about 6 months, I knew that that was not the place to think things over. I just couldn't find my way there, and I was drinking every single day. I mean, I was drinking all the fucking time. And there was never any point of ever exhausting the possibilities of not drinking. And there was just as much drugs, if not more, there. And I kept on using and using. Well, during the time that I was in the Air Force, I got a 502. That was, I think, in 1977. And I was obliged to go into to one of these classes, you know, they have for alcohol and all this type of thing. And two people from AA, two gals from AA went to this class. And they started talking about drugs and alcohol and how it affected them. And something very strange started to happen. I realized that some of the things they were talking about seemed to sound just like the stuff I was going through. But somehow the one thing I couldn't accept was that I was an alcoholic. I know I had a problem that maybe it might be like drugs and alcohol, but I wasn't quite an alcoholic. So I started going to AA meetings, and I started going, and I started, I went most of the time down to 400 Campbell, and I started hearing some of the people that are still around talk, and one of the persons I remember a lot is John C. And I could not stand this man. I mean, I've already told them this, I told him that I could not, just hearing that preacher just upset the shit out of me, you know? So I just decided that, you know, if this was the way it was going to be, I was going to leave. So two things drove me out, I believe. One was personalities, and the other one was the concept of God. I just couldn't handle them at any point or anything. So I left, and I decided to prove to myself that I didn't have a problem. And so what I did was I stopped drinking for 3 years, but I had a Coke occasionally. So, you know, it sort of didn't really count, but I thought it was a good way to prove that I really didn't have a problem. And but what happened was that slowly but surely, when I started drinking again, I started drinking again. And I started just building up and building up and building up. And it took me about somewhere between 2 and 3 weeks to catch up with 3 years of not drinking. And I knew I had a problem. I mean, I really knew I had a problem. And everything was just going to shit. But somehow I still managed to clutch on a month or a week or just some amount of time enough to prove to me that really I wasn't an alcoholic, that really I wasn't an alcoholic. It was the one thing I did not want above anything else. Because you see, in the back of my mind, I remembered my grandfather. Now, they always kept me separate from my grandfather because he drank so much. He was the type of guy that he'd spend forever writing something, and he'd just go ahead and sell it for whatever, you know, two bottles or whatever. He'd spend a year doing something. And he didn't care because it was most important for him to drink than anything else in the world. And I remember the way that my parents taught me about him. You stay away from him because he might teach you something that's not right. And I remember the way that he would sometimes would just go aside and say, look, I want to talk to you about something. He'd try to tell me things. I couldn't see what the fuck he was talking about. I mean, you know, things like, you know, that you've got to do something with your life, you know, all this strange shit, man, you know. I'm doing something with my life already, you know. But the one thing I didn't want to become was something like that. I understood that alcoholism was the worst thing that anybody could ever be. It was the slowest of the lowest of the lowest of the scum. And that's the way that I understood it. Finally, I came into the program again, and I came in sort of on a sidetrack. I came on a sidetrack because I thought that the real problem that I had was the relationship I was in. I had lost all sense of values, all sense of integrity behind a woman that I had a relationship with. And I thought somehow that this was the real problem. But strange enough, at the point where I was going to consider whether I was going to commit suicide or whether I was going to just live one more day or what, for some strange reason, in the back of my mind, I just picked up the phone, called central office, and asked them, where the fuck is the meeting? Where is the fucking meeting? And they told me there's a meeting, but it's already started. And I don't know how fast it took me. I didn't pay attention to nothing. I just grabbed my car and I just came down. And I came into this meeting. It was a new meeting. And all I know is I wasn't sure where it was. I just had to find the room. I came in and I stumbled on a chair and everybody looked at me and I felt like just a ridiculous fool. And I just sat in the corner. And I sat in the corner for weeks. I mean, people would try to talk to me, but I couldn't talk to them. I just could not talk to them. Because the one thing I had never, ever, ever learned was to how to share myself. I had never, ever, I guess, had the courage or just the willingness to show anybody what I was really, really, really like. And so, of course, I was afraid if I told anybody, you know, if I even said anything, I was hurting so bad that if I started crying or if I started saying anything at all, I knew they would knew what I would be. And up until then, I had forgotten all about third tradition, and I had forgotten about it being a suggestive program. But then all of a sudden, you know, just by coming, and maybe I said, maybe it'll be just a little time before they kick me out. I know I'm not contributing anything. They just don't want me here. And then I don't know who it was that said it. I haven't fucking slightest idea. But somebody said, all you need to do is stay here. And stay here is just to not want to drink. And I grabbed onto that, I mean, with a passion, because it was like the best excuse that I could get for keeping on living. I knew that nobody could possibly kick me out. Or if they tried, I wouldn't let them. I refused to let them. Once I'd heard that, I would keep on coming back, and I stayed in the back of the room sometimes, and sometimes I wasn't friendly, and sometimes I had my problems. But the one thing I knew was that nobody could kick me out. And if they tried, I swear to God, I'd fight the shit out of them. I was not going to let that. And, well, I grabbed onto that. Later on, it's an excuse. I took a suggestive program as part of the excuse of sometimes not working things in the way they were supposed to be learned. And but what I learned really fast was, even though it's a suggestive program, the point is that because it's based on reality, if I want something to happen, I can't just imagine it in my mind and hope it'll happen. I have to actually get involved in doing something, and then lo and behold, you know, it actually happens. Like, you know, cause and effect type thing, you know. I never understood that that was the way you do things. I never understood that at all. And I guess it came to when I had some peaks where I had my little pink clouds and everything was kind of mellow. And I believe now that that happens in the worst of situations. We sometimes, I think my higher power or our God, whatever we want to call him, gives us these moments in which we can do something with our lives for the moments that are maybe might be harder later on. You see, I never took advantage of those moments. And what really moved me in the beginning was always pain. When I got to that point of pain, all I knew was I want to get out of the pain, and I don't want to go to more pain that was 2, 3, 4, 5 weeks ago. And eventually, I remember something right now. I was just looking at Rick. One time I saw Rick outside, and he was telling him, he took the steps like they were just running out of style, you know, before I guess he thought that somebody might take them away from him, and he just started going through them like that. And he started sharing me with some of the stuff, and I said, wow, yeah, that's neat, I guess. You know, but I could not relate to it. I just could not understand the need to do this. Because I kept on reading suggested. And I never realized that the suggested, what it implies is that, to me, what it implies now is that I can do this, and I have to do it, because otherwise I won't stay sober. But I can have a different interpretation if I want to, as long as it works. And if it doesn't work, I better move my ass and start asking people why, and start getting a solution somewhere else. Now, what has changed, and I guess as a consequence of grabbing fanatically onto that third tradition, is that I developed an almost fanatical need, once I'd done the steps, to get more. And maybe it might have been pain that moved me in the beginning, but now, more than anything that moves me now, is that I know what it is to have a little bit of peace of mind. Not always, but that moves me more than anything else, because what's really developed in me is like, I just want more. And I want more all the time. And sometimes, you know, I feel like sometimes, you know, I just calm down and just take one thing at a time, take one thing at a time. But you see, I remember really easily what it was that I came from. And when I don't, I have all kinds of little tricks and reminders all around me, because I use all the tricks that I use for using a drink, that I use them now to keep myself sober. But one of the things that I do is I have this sort of like a little, like a drawing I did just before I made that phone call, and it's a portrait of me. And it doesn't mean, I show it to a lot of people just to see what they think about it. And most people don't, oh, that's nice, it's interesting. But the point of it is, to me, is it shows me solidly, even when I forget, because I know how easy it is for me to forget, it shows me where I'm coming from. And if I don't have that, I go into the book and I get reminded all the time. But that picture is just, you know, it's a clown. And he's been tarred, he's been feathered, and he's been beaten the shit out of. And that's exactly the way I felt when I came in. I felt like a clown, totally and completely worthless. No sense of esteem whatsoever. And now the one thing I can tell you is that I have sometimes my doubts, you know, as to whether the different things I should be doing, or whether not as fully confident as I wish I could be. But the one thing I do know, without any doubt, is that I'm in love with this program, with the fanaticism, that I myself, I'm surprised at sometimes. And all I can say is that, you know, especially Saturday Night Live for me, I hear a lot of criticism about Saturday Night Live sometimes. But the way that I feel about it is very simple. There's times when I wanted to get up and pull you and just say, you know, fuck you, fuck everything, fuck the program. But the one thing that I do know is there's 450 meetings in the area. And all that is a pool of resources. You can take anything you want, go to any meetings you want, and there's a lot to pick from. The point is that this place is available for anybody who wants it. And there's a solution in the program. I mean, you can take it or you can leave it. That's what suggestion means to me. Nobody can force anything down on you. But the point is, if you're willing to do it, if you really want it, there's nothing compared to what you can, to what you can really get. Because that is the fucking truth. If you thought you could dream, if there's any glimpse whatsoever about anything being better, man, it doesn't have to be a fucking dream anymore. You can actually live it. I mean, it doesn't have to be a fucking illusion. You don't have to just pretend it anymore. You can actually live it. And it becomes something so important to you that you just don't want to give up.
Thank you, Hugo. Thank you. I'm sure a lot of you have heard him before. He's a very popular speaker. I have heard him, and I really enjoy him. So I wish you would give Dr. Fred a hand. And also, would you please all be quiet, because we've got the tape running. If you have to do anything more than just a little whisper, go outside and talk. Thank you.
I am, as you can see, grief for the past 8 years.
Can you hear me now? And I am the Reverend Dr. Frederick Lindsay, Jr., EDD, PhD, STD, DD, and Fiddle DD. And I'm a fine and foxy old wino. I should like to speak to you tonight for this reason. Heretofore, in my association with Alcoholics Anonymous, I have spoken in AA or in one of its derivative organizations, Al-Anon or Alateen, and I have been participating in a therapy, and I have been the subject. Therefore, the more subjective the talk, the better. And tonight I've been asked to talk about that therapy, and the difference becomes immediately apparent. It seems to me that I should try to be as objective as possible, and this seemed to me to call for advanced thought and preparation. How objective a member can be about an organization which he has been associated with for as long as I have, and it has saved my life, and my sanity is a moot question, but I can try. My task tonight is more difficult than it would first appear, because as those of you who are members of AA already know, there is no official interpretation which I can blithely pass along to you. There is no, quote, party line, end quote. No official body of dogma or doctrine to which the members subscribe. No creed that we recite. even if the surviving co-founder of AA himself were standing before you tonight, he could tell you only how it appears to him. I personally consider this absence of orthodoxy one of AA's strongest and most therapeutic principles, and I hope to cover this in more detail later. But it can be a bit of a burden at a time like this. The fact remains that whatever I say tonight is and must remain a totally personal statement. In fact, what I am about to say might very well be titled A Member's Eye View of Alcoholics Anonymous. And since I am saying it within this group, all I ask is that you listen in the spirit of honest and open-minded inquiry. That was written by Allen Ginsberg, and if you don't have a copy of this, it's free. Get yourself a copy. There are a few still on the rack back there, and whoever wants this one can have it. Now I'm going to shake you up. I want a locomotive. Do you know what a locomotive is? How many of you remember your years in high school when the cheerleaders got up and said, give me a Saturday, give me a night, give me a live? Do you remember those? Okay.
Oh, yeah. Give me a Saturday.
Saturday.
Give me a night.
Night.
Give me a live.
Live.
Give me a Saturday.
Saturday.
Night.
Night.
Live.
Live.
Now, I want you to give someone that you don't know at least seven persons that you don't know a big hug and say, I love you. We began this meeting with the Serenity Prayer. This was written by Reinhold Niebuhr, who was the professor of theology at Union Seminary at Columbia University. And the complete Serenity Prayer reads, God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Living one day at a time, accepting hardships as the pathway to peace, taking as he did this world as it is, not as I would have it, trusting that he will make all things right if I surrender to his will, that I may be reasonably happy in this life and supremely happy with him forever in the next. There was a funeral in New York, and someone decided the first part of this prayer should be incorporated in the obituary. And someone who found the obituary sent it to the central office, and they thought it would be a good idea to use it. So since 1942, we have been using the Serenity Prayer. Since 1943, some gal down in Los Angeles who had platinum ovies and couldn't get into an AA meeting decided that she was going to bust open that door and get in. And she did. And she said, well, don't we read anything out of the big book? Here's the big book. It had 92 pages. The big book now has 164 pages. There have been some changes. For example, in step 7, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. It reads, humbly on our knees, asked him to remove our shortcomings, holding nothing back. The conclusion of the introduction to the fifth chapter, which we hear so often, is as follows. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after have been designed to sell you three pertinent ideas. A, that you are alcoholic and cannot manage your own life. B, that probably no human power can relieve your alcoholism. C, that God can and will. And if you are not convinced on these vital issues, you ought to reread the book to this point, or else throw it away. That's the original manuscript. And don't try to steal it from me tonight, because I'm going to keep my eye on it. Now we have to introduce a new word to some of you. And it is called casuistry. C-A-S-U-R-I-S-T-R-Y. Casuistry. And it is divinely imparted wisdom. Divinely imparted wisdom is the meaning of casuistry. Now, I was the last secretary at the 11 o'clock meeting in the Old Downtown Fellowship on 2nd Street. And just to show that there is some of this divinely imparted wisdom, I would like to read a little out of this ledger. I know Johnny O'Boy can't wait until I put this into his hands. But he's going to have to wait until they put me away. Let God, but for the grace of God, have a good day. It's the only day you have. Love is never having to say, I'm sorry. I have only one day. Let me live it clean and sober. One thing for sure, this program works if you work it. I can't. God can. Why don't I let him? Let me be humble today. Love is like a butterfly. It comes and rests on your shoulders. Keep coming back. We need you. This program is perfect. We are not, thank God. If everything was good every day, we wouldn't keep coming back. I'm glad I'm here. What's really something is I'm glad you're here. In order for me to love you, I have to love myself first. Oh, and collections. The attendance at that particular meeting on April the 22nd, the 29th, was 30. And the collection was $1.70. Here's another entry. $40. 40 people. 40 people. $3.61. 44 people. $4.65. The next entry is 20 people and $1.44. Dr. Fred, 45 people in attendance, and a big collection that night, $7.54. the last meeting that I chaired and was secretary to, we had 16 people and we collected 1 cent. Now comes the commercial. John Panetta, will you stand up? You are now looking at the founder of Saturday Night Live. And after I had been ordained about 8 years ago, I came up with a prayer which Lexi Parsons is responsible for, because she told me, she said, after the meeting, she says, Fred Lindsay, I am so goddamn sick and tired of you asking God to show you what you would have you do. And I was astounded. I said, Lexi, you and your husband just sit right where you are. I'll say, I'll have an answer for you. So I went directly to the head and I sat down and I said, God, what on earth am I doing wrong? And it came to me, why don't you thank me? And in the twinkling of an eye, I got up and I ran out and I said, Lexi, I have it. Good morning, Heavenly Father. Thank you for this day of sobriety, freedom, and joy. And thank you for showing me what you'd have me do and giving me the strength, the courage, and the patience to do thy will. And she put her arms around me and she says, that's my Dr. Fred. So I went home, and there was a $300 a night prostitute waiting for me. And she did the calligraphy on this prayer. Good morning, Heavenly Father. Not good God, it's morning. But good morning, Heavenly Father. Thank you for this day of sobriety, freedom, and joy. And thank you for showing me what you'd have me do and giving me the strength, the courage, and the patience to do thy will. You can have your copy. The next person is going to be 3,580. And I wish that we could get this 400 off the book so that my little friend Dave can have copy number 4,000. There he is for the asking. Come up and see me after the meeting. Now to get into the drunk log. I'm an old man. And when I was just 2, I came down with pneumonia, double pneumonia. And the doctor, Halstead F. Brown, who ushered me into this world, told my mother to go down and get some brandy and give Fred a tablespoonful of brandy every hour on the hour around the clock. And my mother, being a very obedient soul, Lord, she was, saw that I got my brandy every hour on the hour round the clock. So the next day, I felt pretty good. And I got up and danced on the bed. And I felt so good about this dance that I wanted to show my mother. So I called her and I danced for her. And she got alarmed and she called the doctor right away. And he came up in that cold, 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 snowy day. And he brought out that black bag with his cold fingers and his cold stethoscope, started all over me. I was listening and listening and listening. And finally he said to my mother, "I think Freddie is over the crisis, but what we have on our hands now is a drunken little boy." For the next 38 years, my mother had a drunken little boy on her hands. I attended my first meeting on April the 9th in 1953, and there was a very distinguished looking gray-haired gentleman who came up to me after the meeting was over, and he said, "Do you have the price of a fifth of your favorite whiskey?" Jim Beam. And I said, "Yeah." "Well," he said, "I would suggest that you buy this big book." And he handed me a copy of the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, "I want you to go home and learn your ABCs." Well, didn't he know that I was a graduate of Union? Didn't he know that I was a graduate of Columbia? Didn't he know that I was a graduate of Stanford? Didn't he know that I had attended San Jose State? Didn't he know that I had... He didn't know shit. Telling me, who had a special credential from the state of California to teach the gifted children. And he said to me, "You know, we all know who you are." Well, to make a long story short, I finally ended up losing my job, losing my mother, losing my lover, and here all I had left was 17 military decorations that I picked up in the Pacific. And I was so depressed that I went to a psychiatrist, and I told him about my drinking, and he didn't think much of that. That wasn't important. There was something else that was bugging me. So he gave me 100 Librium and 100 Succinols, I think they were. And I went home after 15 years of association with this fellowship and downed every one of those pills. And my sister tells me that she looked in on me a couple of times, but she didn't see me moving. So she called for the ambulance, and they took me to the community hospital. and I was dead on arrival. Now when they came into this room, there was a black woman who was a member of AA. And she looked at this intern who had just come on duty. And she said to him, "Doctor, there's a Stanford man. You're a Stanford man. Now, there is your first patient, and are you going to let your first patient die?" And with that, she laid a tracheotomy kit on my chest, and he opened me up and got me up into intensive care, where I was in a coma for 10 days and 10 nights. And I finally woke up. I couldn't figure out where I was. I had pneumonia, and my whole left side of my body was paralyzed. They got me out, got me into physical therapy, and after that, my sister said, "I think what we're going to do with you now is send you to Agnew." This was in 1968. And the judge was Judge Murphy. And Judge Murphy, I had made a 12-step call on him 12 years prior to this. And he looked at me and he said, "Fred, don't you think you need some help?" And I said, "Yeah." I was so depressed. I didn't care to live. I didn't want to live. There was nothing left. God had forsaken me. But my AA friends didn't forsake me, because when I went to that hospital, I had a half dozen members of AA waiting for me. And every day for 2 years, I had a telephone call, I had a letter, I had a postcard, I had visitors from the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, until the day that I got out. And it was then that I'd had my first heart attack. And they didn't expect me to pull through. And they had me loaded on morphine. And I don't want any more morphine. No way. No way. That pulled me down deeper, deeper, and deeper. And then the Lord has a way of disturbing our nests. Do you know that? The Lord has a way of disturbing our nests. And if you would take the eagles, for example, the beautiful eagles, they mate for life. No divorce among eagles. No separations. When they get together, they get together. And they lay an egg about once every 3 years. And the Papa Eagle goes out and gets these heavy branches and puts them into a crevice. Then he gets some straw and puts them into the nest. And finally they take their feathers and they put them in. She lays an egg. And the first thing you know, 90 days later, the pecking starts. And out comes this little eaglet. And a papa eagle goes out and swarms around and finds a rabbit, finds a mouse, finds a young sheep, finds anything that he has to feed this little guy with. And he feeds him, tenderly cares for him, while the mother eagle is out searching for food, bringing it back, keep coming back, and finally this little eaglet begins to grow, and he wants to stretch out. So the papa eagle pulls the feathers out of the nest. And then a week or so later, the mother will take the straw out of the nest. And finally, we're down to the bottom of the nest, which is these heavy branches. And this little eaglet is very, very unhappy. He hasn't been working his steps. And finally, the papa eagle spreads his wings way out in majesty. And this little eaglet sees this. And he stands in awe of his father. And the father says to the little fellow, "Get on my right wing. We're going for a ride." So he takes him out, and they soar around, and they soar around, and they soar around, and then they come back. The next day, it's the same thing. And about a week later, while this little eagle is enjoying this free ride, which we call the honeymoon, he suddenly does a nosedive. And this little eagle is fluttering and fluttering and fluttering and yelling, "Papa, Papa, Papa, why hast thou forsaken me?" And the papa eagle will watch him, and finally at 90 miles an hour will nosedive down and very gently pick this little guy up. He's still holding on, holding on. Hold on. Don't take that first drink and you won't get drunk. Hold on. Hold on. And a year later, this little eagle is out on his own. And he finds a mate when he's mature, about 3 years old. And the cycle turns around and around and around. This is why sponsorship is so important. I was talking to a man here Thursday night who had a roommate that he asked to leave because his maturity was that of a 29-year-old man, but his emotions were that of a 13-year-old. And I said to him, "Why didn't you take Chuck by the hand and gently with patience, lead him. If you don't have a sponsor that you can trust with your innermost secret desires, your most secret wants, your longing, and if you don't love your sponsor, get another one. Find somebody that you can identify with. It's easy. I think that every one of us here in this room will be happy if someone would come up to you and say, "Will you be my sponsor?" Yeah, when they ask me if I'll be their sponsor, I always say, "Yes, I'll be your sponsor, but not on your terms. They have to be on mine." It's 9:55. What time do we close? 10:00. Well, here I am tonight, and here you are tonight, and all we have is today. Yesterday is a canceled check. Tomorrow is a promissory note. Today is cash on hand. And we have to learn to practice these principles in all our affairs. And in conclusion, I want to give you the message. It is a plain fact that a life which includes deep resentments leads only to futility and unhappiness. To the price extent that we permit these, do we squander the hours that might have been worthwhile? But with the alcoholic, whose hope is the maintenance and growth of a spiritual experience, this business of resentment is infinitely grave. We found that it is fatal. For when harboring such feelings, we shut ourselves off from the sunlight of the Spirit. The insanity of alcohol returns, and we drink again. And with us, to drink is to die. If we were to live, we had to be free from anger. The grouch and the brainstorm were not for us. They may be the dubious luxury of normal men, but for alcoholics, these things are poison. The message. Having had a spiritual awakening, not an experience, but an awakening, as a result of these 11 steps, we tried we tried to carry the message to the alcoholic who is still suffering and practice these principles in all of our affairs. And if you will write this down, on page 94, you will find what the message is. On your first visit, tell him about the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. Simple. The second part of the message, offer him friendship, offer her friendship and fellowship. Tell him or her, if he wants to get well, that you will do anything to help. And the third part of the message is, let him or her know you are available if he or she wishes to make a decision and tell his story. But do not insist upon it if he prefers to consult someone else. And fourthly, and finally, burn the idea into the consciousness of every man or every woman that he or she can get well regardless to anyone. The only condition is that he trust in God and clean house. The last time that Chuck Chamberlain was in San Jose, Chuck, as you know, was about 85 or 86 when he died just a few months ago. And I remember him and Elsa talking that for 16 years they didn't know the word serenity. Why? Because they could not accept their son's sexual orientation. But once having accepted Richard's orientation, they were free. They were free. You too can be free. You don't have to live that way anymore. Don't take the first drink and you can't get drunk. Don't take the first fix and you can't get bombed out of your gourd. Don't take the first. Now I'd like to leave you with my blessing. In the name of the Father, the Son, and of the Holy Ghost. Amen. And the Lord bless thee and keep thee. The Lord make his face to shine upon thee and be gracious unto thee. And the Lord lift up his countenance upon thee and give thee peace, prosperity, good health, and the abundant life with sobriety, freedom, and joy. God love you.
Thank you, Dr. Fred.